Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thanks for downloading, subscribing, rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, you can get used to pretty much anything. Losing a leg, the smell of an abattoir. Even my producer Aidan has sort of settled into a resigned state of acceptance after having to deal with me for the last few weeks. Why is that? Well, Cass Sunstein has written a book called Look Again, looking at this signs of habituation. We'll be speaking to him in a bit. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Ruth, is an intriguing one. It has to do with gut bacteria and the eye.
It does. And it has to do with eye diseases that we kind of know have a strong genetic component. So they're related to a genetic mutation. But this is new work that comes out of University College London and researchers in China that was published in the journal Cell this week, which suggests that the picture might be a bit more complicated than we thought. And that is an association between infection and actually bacteria getting into the eye and the genetic mutation. So the researchers used a mouse model and they looked at this gene that they know is involved in a number of different genetic eye diseases, including things like retinitis pigmentosa, where this gene is involved in about 10% of cases. So this gene is called the Crumb's homolog 1 or CRB1. And what they found was in mice that lacked this gene, the integrity of their gut essentially failed. So bacteria, you know, we've got trillions of bacteria in our gut and a lot of them are doing us good, but it's not so good if they start to leak out into our bloodstream. And what they found was this mutation also increased the porosity of the barrier between the eye and the blood. And so they found bacteria in the eyes when this disease was happening. So what they're saying is perhaps it's in fact the fact that the mutation is weakening the membranes or allowing things to travel between the bloodstream and the eye that is in fact causing the disease, not a genetic component that's structurally stopping sight happening in these cases.
Right, because normally you don't find bacteria or viruses in the eye because it like there's a barrier
exactly.
In the same way the blood-brain barrier.
Exactly, so you've got the blood-ocular barrier, very like the blood-brain barrier, keeps everything very sterile. But of course, so that was a really, really remarkable discovery. But what was even more interesting, and they are kind of saying, look, people shouldn't get too excited, but actually administering antibiotics cured the eye disease, which is pretty incredible. So once
RP,
this mouse model of RP, so it's not exactly the same RP, and all RP is not caused by a mutation in this gene.
Yeah.
You know, it's much more complex than that. But I think it is a bit of a paradigm shift because these are diseases that we've sort of historically associated with mutations. They have a very strong genetic component, but actually now marrying that with the fact that the mutation in the gene is actually leading to bacterial infection.
So RP is obviously, in some cases, it leads to you know, blindness. There's no cure known for it. There's lots of sort of fraudulent offerings out there, but there's no actual cure for it. But, I mean, I would have presumed that we would have tried, you know, delivering antibiotics to the eye. But I guess that the point is, no one thought there was bacteria there in the first place. So that's, they wouldn't have done that. Is that right?
I think so. And I mean, you're right. Like inherited eye disease are the biggest cause of blindness in working age people. So it's a really big issue. And there are researchers, including at Trinity College, looking at gene therapies to try and restore some of these genes that are broken in eye conditions. But this is potentially that there's a subset of these eye conditions where the genetic component is actually allowing an infection to happen. And again, it's that leakiness from the gut, which is getting into the bloodstream and then potentially getting into the eye.
Which is a much easier thing in theory to fix than messing with the genes and a genetic therapy.
Exactly.
Wow. Shane, our second story is a really interesting one. It has to do with fossil forgery, which does happen quite a bit given the value of it, but we don't hear about it very often.
Yeah, it's one of those areas that's seemingly ripe for fraud in science. This is a so-called 280 million year old lizard fossil that's turned out completely to be a fake. It was discovered in the Alps in 1931, the Italian Alps, and it's of Tridentinosaurus antiquus. Well, it's not really, but that's what the person who made it wanted it to look like. And they were very convincing, whoever made it. As I said, it's lizard-like, and if you saw it, if you were able to see it, you'd see this lizard-like creature that's still embedded in a piece of rock. So they didn't take it fully out of the rock. It really is convincing. So convincing that a scientist before thought that there was carbonized skin traces on it. Right? It must have been from people touching it, and I don't know, but like it was contaminated in some way. But enter a Dr. Valentina Rossi from University College Cork, who was assuming this thing was real and decided to use something called ultraviolet photography to look a little deeper beyond the skin of the fossil, as she thought it was. And when she did the work, she and her group, she was looking for soft tissue, what lied beneath, and found that it was completely fake. Completely fake. Yeah, and that the whole thing was just painted in black paint, and that there was nothing of substance to it. And someone made it, and as you hinted at the start, probably because it was worth a fortune to discover a fossil. And as you also said, there's a bit of a history in this area, which I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with. Imagine.
Oh, God. I mean, this is another story to file under my archaeology. Like, just, I mean, Jesus.
Piltdown Man is, of course, the most famous one, right? 1912, Charles Dawson in Sussex had fraudulently put bone fragments and presented them as the so-called missing link. That took 41 years to
what if it's all fake? Can I just throw this out there, right? And, like, what if it's all fake? What if there's no such thing as dinosaurs? I'm just asking. I know this is a science program, but I'm just asking.
Yeah.
Have we looked at all the dinosaur bones? What if like half those species are just people with a bit of tippex?
Well, Ruth and I haven't, but you know, we have to trust the process that's there, which is called peer review, which eventually...
My trust is eroding.
Yeah. I mean, I think the good thing about the dinosaurs is we've lots of different strands of evidence from lots of different branches of science. So we have our living relative dinosaurs, living relatives of dinosaurs, the birds that are still with us.
Yeah.
You know, we've archaeology, we've lots of different branches of science.
But fraud's on the rise. You should chat to, I think you have before, Elizabeth Bick, the detective in science, and she's looking at fraudulent behaviour in science. And
what if there's no dinosaurs?
Well, there are dinosaurs, or there were. But there still are,
There are theoretically dinosaurs.
Birds, yeah.
Don't do that to me, Jonathan.
Well, I'm not obviously, you know, I mean, I 99.999 absolutely believe in dinosaurs.
But if someone gave you a fossil, would you be like, I would.
I don't know anymore. Like, I don't know. The stories that come out of this area of science seem so crazy. And it's over and over again in this program. It's like, oh, yeah, no, that was actually a child with Down syndrome. It wasn't a new species of human. Like, what? Like, what are you talking about?
But isn't it good that correction happens in science?
Exactly.
It is. But like, yeah, okay. Our third story, Ruth, has to do with drug delivery. And this is a really interesting one because we pinned a lot of hopes on AI being able to solve a lot of problems for us. But when we apply it in certain areas, the results don't always yield what we hope.
Yeah, so this it's about drug discovery and it's really about small molecule drugs. And if you think about what those are, imagine a kind of lock and a key and you have a little receptor on a cell in your body and that's the lock. And, you know, when you put a key in that lock, something happens in the cell. So you either block a pain pathway or you stop an infection happening. And what scientists are trying to do all the time is identify the locks and the keys. So what are the locks that go wrong in disease or what are the pathways we have to target? And then can we find a key that's going to fit? And of course, there's millions of possibilities of pairs that you could find. And often drug companies spend years and billions of dollars screening different kinds of small molecules to see if they can find drugs. But you're right, the sort of promise of AI to look through vast amounts of data came along. And also, I think with DeepMind, this idea that we could predict protein structures, because these locks and keys are usually made of proteins and proteins are very, very complicated. And usually we've used techniques like crystallography to work out what shape they actually are. But we actually can make a pretty good stab at predicting what shape a protein is likely to be using AI. So the next obvious step was to say, well, could we predict what's going to stick to that protein or what's the key for that lock? And this is a program, it's called the Critical Assessment of Computational Hit-Finding Experiments, the CASH competition. It's run by the Structural Genomics Consortium. And this particular competition was supported by the Michael J. Fox Foundation. And they picked a target that's very relevant to Parkinson's disease. So this is a drug target that people have been looking at for a long time but have failed to find any targets.
Yeah.
So they had 23 teams that signed up to try and find the key. And they each predicted hundreds of different compounds. But as you say, the results really weren't that great. Less than 1% of the over 2,000 compounds that they came up with had any binding affinity for the protein at all. And in fact, it wasn't even that strong, the affinity between the keys that they came up with and this particular lock that's relevant to Parkinson's disease. So it was a bit disappointing in a way.
Yeah, but again, probably even the fact that it's publishing now, you're talking about AI that is probably 3-4 years old, the potential for this generation or 5 years from now generation, it probably is exponential in terms of the potential for it. But it is interesting because
you
I remember reading about these stories.
You won't hear a bad word about AI, will you, John?
No, absolutely. It's interesting. It's really interesting. But I do think, you know, the next few years as we continue will only... What's your problem with AI?
I just think it's bleh. You know,
These are old-fashioned.
Shane, I have to say that the market...
Because you have a grandfather clock in your house.
The market agrees with Johnny, because if you look at companies, about half of these groups that apply were academic and half came from some startups. But if you look at the kind of market capital of those startups, today drug discovery AI startups are worth about 1.4 billion. This is predicted to go to 3.7 billion by 2027.
So investors check the markets,
are
Shane.
Going into this.
The markets
space.
Don't lie.
But the other thing is, you know, as the people doing this are saying, this is about pushing it forward. You know, this was a really tough target. They're going to look at some other targets. And I should say they did use lab approaches as well. It wasn't a purely AI-based thing, and they have to validate everything once they find it.
Okay. Our final story, Shane, has to do with music.
It does. And why we feel that kind of tingly, emotional, you know, that feeling you get when you hear live music, like nothing compares to it, right? And this is a study that was done in Zurich, and they composed 12 pieces of music, each of them 30 seconds long. Half of them conveyed negative emotions, so sadness, anger, lots of slow things, less harmony, minor chords. The other half were positive. And they recruited 27 people, none of whom were musicians, and they put them all separately into an MRI machine to look at brain activity. And people heard all 12 pieces, and they heard them in two different ways. They heard live versions and they heard recorded versions, and they didn't know when they were listening which one they were hearing.
Right.
And they found that when they were listening to live music, that a certain part of their brain that's associated with emotional processing lit up to a much greater extent than it did when they were listening to recorded music. Now, what I find interesting about this is that they didn't know it was live. So there wasn't any sense of, at least they weren't consciously aware that it was live.
Yeah.
I was wondering, I know that when you have, like, even the best speaker can never convey the full breadth of frequencies that you hear when you hear live music. And so I wondered, was it that it's just that your ear picks up a lot more? It's subconscious and your brain responds to it. The professors involved said that this is really interesting. They were surprised too. They do recognize that there is a huge amount of social factors that influences the feeling we get when we hear live music, being with others, etc. But they said this is pretty cool, isn't it? It's answering a question perhaps that we all knew already, that live music is much better than recorded when it comes to that kind of tingly feeling that you get.
Yeah, very interesting. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, thank you very much. Now, modern life is full of amazing and disturbing things. There are large tubes of people flying through the skies. Our fellow citizens sleep on the streets in various states of need. We have these incredible futuristic tools called smartphones, which we mostly use to scroll through inane videos and argue with people in far-flung parts of the world. All of this happens, and we just shrug as if it's completely normal. Why? Well, Cass Sunstein is Robert Walmsley University Professor at Harvard and co-author of Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Cass. I guess this is a timely publication in a way, because all around the world, there have been sort of signs growing of danger. And yet, because like the frog in the pot, the temperature goes up by 1 degree every year, we've sort of become almost used to really worrying things.
That sounds right. Thank you for having me. So here's the foundation of it. The brain is very alert to change and not so alert to stability or very slow or incremental change. So if the surprise signal goes off in the brain, maybe you see some amazing food near you, or maybe an attractive potential mate passes by, then the brain is on alert. If you're in a standard situation or a situation that's getting a little better or a little worse every day, then your brain just kind of nods and says a quiet oh.
I'm thinking, obviously, a little bit of climate change, because that's become sort of background noise to us, even though every year the differences are really stark given the time frame. I'm also thinking of political change in America. It seems to me that liberties of many Americans are being taken away bit by bit. And while definitely people are noticing, people are making noise of it, there isn't the Tea Party revolt. You know, the Tea Party revolution was about a cent extra tax on tea, if I'm not wrong, back in the day. And now we're seeing things like the erosion of Roe versus Wade, but lots of, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, huge changes in areas where ordinarily that would be, let's burn the country down. And now it just doesn't seem to provoke the same sort of response.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the foundations and then get to politics. So if you're, you know, married and have a good family, after 10 years, it becomes for most people routinized and good, but it doesn't have the kind of sparkle or thrill that it would have if before you got married, you envisioned, you know, this amazing partner and this amazing family. If something is not good at work, maybe someone's mean who has power over you, or maybe there's something that's like a painful thorn in your foot, you stop noticing it after a while, even though if you'd been hit by it all of a sudden in the full force that you're now experiencing it, you would have thought, what's happening here? How can I stand it? Mm. Studies of the rise of fascism in Germany in the 30s show that, though we don't think of it this way at the time, it was pretty incremental, that it's not like Hitler in his full horror was that Hitler in his first 6 months. It was step by step. And so people who were there at the time said, you know, with incredulity, like 15 years after when the war was over, they said it was like a field where the growth was higher and higher and higher, and you didn't notice it until it was over your head. Hmm. And it was the incremental nature of it. Take your pick of countries in Europe or the United States, in North America, maybe more broadly, where things are different now from where they were 12 years ago. I'm pretty upbeat about my own country. That's probably my nature. But the fact is there are some things happening that have happened slowly that wouldn't have been tolerable if they happened all of a sudden.
Talk to me about what happens in our brain. How does habituation work, do we know?
Okay, so let me tell you a study that my co-author, Tali Sharat, did in her laboratory. People were told, come to the lab and do an experiment about cooperation, where if you cooperate with a partner who will be a stranger, you can make some money. And involved a cognitive task. And then some of the members of the subject group were told, actually, you can make more money if you lie. If you lie to your partner, you can make more money. So they were given an incentive to lie. Early on, the people who lied, and there was a good number, showed activity in the amygdala, which is a part of the brain that's associated with strong emotion. The amygdala was, and this is a lawyer talking, on fire. It was activated and saying, no, 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 this is not morally right. Red, red, red. And people persisted with the lie because the money was attractive. Now, here's the cool part, or the horrifying part. As the day went by, the amygdala started quieting more and more. So by the end of the day, the amygdala, which was raising a big red neurological flag in the head, started saying, okay, giving a kind of permission slip to the person, because the amygdala habituated to lying. Now, this is true in the brain. If you go in cold water, your brain is going to send you, like the ocean, let's say in Waterville, where I spend parts of summers, you go swimming in Waterville, and the brain is going to be saying, cold, danger, warning. But after 15 minutes, the brain is saying, keep swimming, it's nice, the water's fine. And that happens in the brain for cold, it happens for heat, it happens for unkindness, it happens for something magnificent and wonderful, and it does happen for, let's say, misinformation or lying on social media or one's own morally questionable conduct.
I'm trying to think about the evolutionary advantage of getting used to something. I suppose it's double-edged, right? Because if you get really constantly stimulated by nothing changing that much, that's not great. But if you get really used to something, doesn't that stop you from trying out new things, exploring and conquering the world, which is, you know, what our species ended up doing?
Well, this is a great question. Okay, so you and I are actually related, and not only because married to an Irish woman, but because our distant ancestors were the same. And our distant ancestors, they didn't look a lot like us. They were less cultured. They couldn't talk. They were smaller. Would do nothing if things were not changing. But if things changed, they would start to swim and get very active. These are unicellular organisms, my grandma and grandpa, and their sensitivity to change was evidently adaptive, because if things are, and consistent with, evolutionary pressures, because if things are steady, chances are that there's no new danger to alert oneself to, or no new opportunity to alert oneself to. If suddenly you hear a loud crashing noise, or if suddenly there's some creature who's in your presence that you've never seen before, to be completely on the alert is a good use of cognitive resources. If you're in a cave, let's say, and everything is quiet, there's a hum that you've heard for 30 consecutive days, to be marshaling your cognitive resources for, let's say, what you need to do, which is food and romance, maybe, that's adaptive. Mm. So the best evolutionary account is that habituation is essential for species to prosper.
There's so many examples of this. I'm thinking of my own tinnitus, which in the morning is horrible. And then as soon as I get up, it's not something I think about. Then when I go to bed and it's quiet again, then it's something I think about. But you get distracted and you don't think about it. But I'm also thinking of that great Milgram experiment, which we did a feature on a long time ago. Stanley Milgram, his obedience study, which came in the wake of World War II, where you had Nazis standing on trial saying, I was just following orders. And he wanted to know, do we just follow orders? And there was habituation in this test. He got people to try and answer questions. And the person answering a question was an actor. And the person asking the questions was a real volunteer who didn't know what was going on. And the volunteer was asked to increase the voltage every time this actor got a question wrong. And there was a habituation to hurting that happened right in front of people's eyes in that experiment.
Yeah, completely. And I think you put it very precisely, if I may say. So, and this is a kind of a reassessment of what Milgram actually found, which you've stated, and I agree with. So let's take the original assessment and then do the reassessment. Milgram's view was that he was studying obedience to authority, and the fact that he could get ordinary people in an experimental setting to administer an extremely painful electric shock to a stranger, he thought showed why Nazism and other horrors are possible, that people will obey authorities and in a way that is inconsistent with their own deepest moral convictions. I think that's not the full picture, that what he did was to get people to habituate to giving electric shocks, a little like, maybe a very vivid and simplified version of what authoritarian leaders do. Mm. The first shocks were real, but they weren't very painful. And then they went up by increments, slow, small increments. I think there were dozens. And that means that by the time people were giving, let's say, a very painful shock, they had softened in their emotional response to giving electric shocks. If people had been asked at the first moment, give a severe electric shock to a stranger, then the amygdala and associated parts of the brain would have been very activated. And I speculate that a number of people would have said, no, are you kidding?
It's probably a mix of the two, right? I mean, I don't think the listening to authority and the obedience of someone in a white coat it can be completely taken out of the equation. I think there's probably a mix of both. But is there a time span on this? I mean, in the book, I think you say, you know, the smell of coffee, 20 minutes, and it's, you know, and it's something you're used to if you're in a coffee shop. But is there a certain amount of time it takes for us to habituate to certain things, or does it depend on the context?
It varies with the person. Let's start with that, that some people habituate more readily than others. And in fact, a defining feature, this is something we learned in the context of the book, a defining feature of mental health challenges is an inability to habituate. So people who suffer from schizophrenia, let's treat that as the most dramatic, they just don't habituate. Schizophrenia is defined by a failure of habituation. People who suffer from depression and anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder, they are not habituating in the same way people who don't have those challenges do. And in the COVID shutdown, most people, after the shutdown started, recovered with startling speed to the same level of well-being they reported and evidenced before the shutdown. So people, the first month was awful, you may remember. But after a while, people thought, okay, I can handle this. And they were basically fine. But people with mental health challenges didn't recover. And that's because to habituate to a new status quo is harder for them.
I was somewhere in between the two. I didn't have mental health challenges, but I certainly did not. I certainly was not fine after a month.
Also, to your point, the particular thing to which people might or may not habituate matters. To habituate to intermittent headaches or chronic pain is really hard. Pain is more challenging to habituate to, and that is worse if it's intermittent rather than steady.
Yeah.
We want to be careful in saying that people can't habituate to pain, because if people go in really hot water for a bath, it's very painful at the beginning, but after a while, it's just really warm. It's nice.
What about the people who don't habituate? The people who constantly are saying, wait a second, this isn't right, and manage, I suppose, to stand up in times of political concern, I would say. I mean, what I see in America does concern me. And what happened in the UK, the lie that was Brexit, and how people have just, you know, for the most part, just got on with their lives despite the enormous corruption and the fact that they were lied to over and over again. I mean, it's funny, but there are some people who stand out, you know, the Gretas of this world, who say no, and they say it loudly. I mean, those people are really valuable, right? What is it different about those, do we know?
Okay, this is great. So as you're talking, I was thinking of Shelley saying that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Poets are the unacknowledged disabituators of the world, many of them at least. So if you read a poem, whether it's about nature or romance or politics, let's think of Yeats. Read When You're Old by Yeats. It's disabituating. It makes you see things. They're full of color. And things that would otherwise be just life, they're all of a sudden animated. Now, there are people who aren't literary figures who are political disabituators. In my country, Martin Luther King was a disabituator who said segregation is not, you know, the state of nature. It's not something that we should get used to. It's like a punch in the nose every day. And people felt that punch in the nose because he was, and this is our term for it, a disabituation entrepreneur. Let's name two people from Ireland, shall we? Michael Collins was a disabituation entrepreneur. My wife, Samantha Power, she won't like my saying this, but she is that too. She wrote a book called A Problem from Hell, which was a response to genocide. And that book had a profound effect because it made people think of something in a way that wasn't gray anymore. It was surrounded by very ugly colors.
So is that a personality type that we should be trying to culture? those who sort of struggle in the stream?
I think so. So John Stuart Mill is a hero of our book, and he was a great critic of conformity, thinking that individuality needs to be given free rein. I mean, of course, there are limits. You don't want people who are violent to be giving free rein to that. But he thought it was a source of social progress. And one of the, he didn't have this term, but he had a pretty good intuitive understanding of habituation, that individuals who are freed to follow their convictions, etc., are often the primary source of progress. Now, there are dishabituation entrepreneurs who are evil, who, you know, you could think of Lenin as a dishabituation entrepreneur. I'm not pro-Lenin, or Fidel Castro as a dishabituation entrepreneur. Hmm. I'm not pro-Castro. So we need to know a little bit the content of where they're seeking to get us dishabituated. But in general, I like what you say.
Yeah, and I think our history is littered with these sort of characters that have even written poetry in order to stand up and dishabituate from the things that they were living in at the time. Really interesting speaking with you, and thank you so much for your time. The book is called Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There. The author is Cass Sunstein. Thanks for your time, Cass.
Thank you. A great pleasure.
It is kind of funny, the idea that you can just get used to actually anything. And of course, people do. People go through traumatic events. They go through war or horrors or whatever. And then they just get used to that new normal, which I think is kind of odd. If you have become, I don't know why I throw these out. We don't get enough stories from you. Dear listener, make the effort. This is a good one, right? We want to hear if you have been, sound desperate now, if you have grown accustomed to something that you never thought you could grow accustomed to, whether it's a child or a disease or whatever. We'd love to hear from you. Is it something you don't think of anymore? I'm struck by Panty, who just became completely used to living with HIV and talks about it now as, I just get up, I take a pill in the morning and never think about it again. And that's, you know, an amazing thing to get accustomed to as someone who lived through the 80s, as he did, and watched, you know, friends die around him. So have you become accustomed to something? We'd like to hear your stories. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me in studio to go through some of your comments from last week.
Yeah, much less wordy than the panty story. The thing that people have become accustomed to, that I want to snap them out of it, come on people, is if you're on a bus or you're in a public space and people are scrolling through their Instagram, no headphones. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't
just
like
meh,
that.
Meh. It's like, have not people lost their minds? Like, or they're doing like, calls on speakerphone, like video calls.
No.
Often about private things, right in front of everyone else. No, not okay, people. Let's not go there.
Well, I hate noise. And I've become really, really sensitive to it. There was a TED talk by a fella, bald guy, very good speaker. Can't remember what it was. But he was talking about, you know, silence and noise and sound. And it really stayed with me as an idea. His name obviously didn't, but it really stayed with me as an idea of how special sound is. And it's something that's, I suppose, driven me to want to make the sort of documentary we released a couple of weeks ago and just really explore sound as both as a DJ and so on. But I find it amazing that people can be around that sort of noise and not lose their minds. Like, yeah. I will always say, sorry, can you turn that down? And I'm always that guy. Because I would sit in a restaurant, and if the refrigerator is at the wrong frequency, if it's going, I'll say, can you turn that refrigerator off, or can you move us? Because I can't be around it.
Yeah,
like I'm quite sensitive to sound, not in a hyper, you know, well, maybe hypersensitive to it, but like sound is really important to me. It's amazing actually that you can go to a restaurant and they'll get the sound wrong. You know, they'll see people right beside like a really loud flipping, you know, money machine, or that they won't try and think of, like, maybe people don't want to hear the clatter of plates all the time, because you go into fight or flight if you hear a really loud noise. You hear that all the time. It's terrible. I went to a really fancy restaurant, Tear, right? It just got a second Michelin star.
Are you going to McDonald's or something? Because maybe that's the higher end ones are supposed to be focused on the whole experience, the sounds, the looks, the everything.
But so we went to Tear, right, which is down in a Castle Marder Hotel. we went there and everything was so amazing. The look, the smell, the story they told, the whole experience was amazing. But the chef had prepared a playlist of really, really boring 80s rock, like Bachman Turner Overdrive. And this weird, so we were like, I mean, it was just such an odd and discordant soundtrack to this, you know, unbelievable feast of the eyes and mouth and senses and touch and
he might as well jump.
It was really, I was like, I actually said, I'm sorry, just, is this piped in from the hotel? And the waiter said, no, this is the chef's personal favorite playlist. And I was like, that's got to go. Anyway,
interesting choice.
Shout out to Tear, amazing experience, but you might want to hope they've changed that the playlist. Anyway, we were talking to Cass Sustine there about habituation.
Yes.
One thing I didn't ask him is how to solve this, because I didn't.
Because you're an arch pessimist and you were like, this is great, it's bleak.
I don't revel in the bleak. I feel like I'm a pragmatist, you know. I mean, I asked him, you know, do we need more people like Greta and so on, and Rosa Parks and all that in our lives. But his way of solving it was a little bit underwhelming. Like, it's travel, broaden your horizons and stuff. I don't know. I don't think.
It is, I get what you're saying. It is underwhelming and it's kind of vague. It was travel. It was read books from people from different perspectives, watch films of people from different perspectives. But I do think that, like, that is a, I mean, you have a certain amount of privilege.
People already do that. We still have a screwed up world.
Well, they do it, but like, I think what he's saying is, hey, you know, everyone travels, they go on holidays, but do they travel to, like, you know, often you just go to a beach resort. That's not quite the same thing.
No.
I think as he's talking about. Now, I'm aware of my privilege here. I've just come back from a long stint of traveling, so obviously I'm going to be the guy going,
any excuse to
talk about my travels. But it does, like, it's funny, like, one of the things that struck me was, one of the places we went was Eastern Turkey. And there, when you go to Eastern Turkey, there is a warning on the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs page about Turkey, and Eastern Turkey in particular, about, oh, you know, you need to be very careful going to the city in the south, which is like Sanliurfa. I was going to see a place called Göbekli Tepe, so I had to go to Sanliurfa. And I went into they were saying it was dodgy because of the Syrian conflict and the fact that terrorists came across the border and all this type of stuff. And of course, so I took precautions and I went in there, but I went in so tense and so like, oh, I'm going to be like the white person here and I'm going to be very noticeable and it's all a bit dangerous. I'm not exaggerating. They were the friendliest people I've ever met in my entire life. And my whole perception of what that part of the world was about was totally askew from the warning. And also then my whole perception about hospitality, because we're pretty good at hospitality in Ireland. But this was a whole other level. Like, some guy bought me, or some guy stopped us where we were, like, we were just looking at a viewpoint, and he came over speaking German to me and my girlfriend. My girlfriend's German. And we thought he was looking for us to help with his car. But actually, he wanted to bring us over to his van so we could have a cup of tea and some sandwiches with him and his wife, just some random guy. Half an hour later, went to a restaurant. Nobody there spoke English. The owner found one of the customers who spoke English and asked him to explain the menu to us. He was like, don't worry about the menu. I know what's good in here. I'll pick stuff for you. Would you like a drink? And then he paid for our drinks for the whole night. This customer just kept randomly buying us drinks. And it was such an odd level of hospitality that it kind of changed my whole perspective on hospitality.
Mm.
And I think you get those experiences when you see other cultures, especially if you have preconceptions about them.
Yeah. And I think they happen more often in places where you don't often see people.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are people who want you to know that this part of the world is actually not what you see in a Hollywood movie, I think. And that, like, I've had those sort of experiences, and they're usually in sort of, you know, in middle of nowhere towns.
True. But there is that. But also then there are the cultural differences that make you realize that the basic idea that you have about life, it's just your basic idea. It's not everybody's basic idea. Like, I remember asking a Vietnamese person, there was a lot of lads sitting around chatting, and I do see sitting. They were sitting on their hunkers, which I actually find very hard to do. I don't bend that way. And I said to the local Vietnamese person, why are they all on their hunkers instead of standing? And he just went to me, why do you Westerners all stand instead of being on your hunkers? I was like, okay. I hadn't thought about it that way. I suppose it's just what we do. We think is normal. What they do, they think it's normal.
Yeah. Very good. That's weird, though. I mean, to me, that's weird to me that surely there's a difficulty in sitting on your hunkers that doesn't arise when you're standing.
No, well, you see, they've done it for some. Well, I think I'm assuming they've done it since they were kids, that they do stretch that way.
Yeah.
But it's like they're on an invisible stool. They're really comfortable. Their feet are outside of, like, either side of their ass, and their ass is almost on the ground. They're just sitting there.
This is quite the segue if you're listening. The podcast doesn't normally go off on this one, but we haven't seen each other in quite some time, actually. This is the first time we've had a chance to chat since he's come back traveling. Right, to some of your texts and comments from last week. We were talking about evolution coming off the back of the garbage patch conversation with Jim Carlton, where he was talking about new ecology that's happening and new ecosystems and new species thriving on these giant garbage patches of plastic in the ocean. I mean, it's real meta, isn't it? Kevin says, if you have a long, honest look into the subject, you'll find that there's no evidence to support the theory of evolution. That is one reason it remains a theory. Everything in the natural world suggests design, and if you cannot have design without a designer. Scientists have to kowtow to theory in order to get to the scientific monolith. The theory of evolution had to be changed, and as it became more and more absurd to the scientific community, one could even say it evolved. Well, Kevin, thanks for your comment, and you're absolutely entitled to your opinion. I come from a different place where I guess I don't have faith. I want to see proof, and I trust that people who look at these things and have gone to study these things, I have more faith in humans than that study and provide proof than humans who say, you must believe, and that's that. So I think, you know, if you look at the evidence,
there's more evidence
for everything that science suggests than not. To get things wrong, of course, but there's way more evidence for the fact that there is just evolution to this planet. But like it is, like the whole thing is mad. Like, all of it is mad.
Yes,
everything is mad. But there is the absolutely no evidence whatsoever theologian thing, and then there's a bunch of evidence that you can take it or leave it, but at least it's something. And that's where I'm kind of pointed. Another person, Alan, was texting in about the brightest object in the sky. It was a story that Shane covered. He said the brightest object in the universe was the same as half the distance to Alpha Centauri, but he said it was 7 light years across, which is almost double the distance from here to Alpha Centauri. So it's even madder than we thought. Alan, I love that you outgeeked Shane Bergen. I will bring that up with him next time I see him. Thank you very much for that. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thank you to Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Steve Daunt, Hugo De Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.